Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Little Mermaid, You Hurt My Feelings, The Starling Girl, The Wrath of Becky, and FUBAR. I'm also going to be talking about some news, The Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Influencer. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
And of course, everybody was saying that Fast X was going to be a huge juggernaut, and it did well. It did well. It made $67 million in its opening weekend. But here's the thing. That's actually not great for a Fast and Furious movie. That's the lowest opening weekend for a Fast and Furious movie since Tokyo Drift in 2006. 2006! If you track the box office of the Fast and Furious movies, the first three were just sort of like middling little action movies. And it wasn't until the fourth one actually kind of got people interested in it with the original parts, again, with Paul Walker and Vin Diesel in it together. And then it wasn't until Fast Five, the fifth one, that it sort of morphed into these street racing versions of a James Bond movie. And then those started to do very, very well. Fast 5 was a huge hit. Fast and Furious 6 was a huge hit. Furious 7 was the highest grossing of all of them, I believe. And that was also the sort of the swan song for Paul Walker. Ever since that, the 8th and the 9th and the 10th movies, you've had diminishing returns. Now, they still make a lot of money, but the numbers actually here in the States aren't great. These movies struggle to make $200 million in the States. What saves these movies is the international box office. Over the weekend, it made $250 million plus just in the international box office. Some of these movies make 75% or more, 80% of their money overseas. These are not really as popular as the movies are. They're not that popular here in the States. So this is showing that it's continuing to drop a bit in the States. And even though it's doing well overseas, it's one of those mixed bags. It's something like The Great Wall with Matt Damon, which did extremely well in China, but flopped in the U.S. Same thing with Warcraft. That movie was dismal in America, but it made enough money overseas to make a sequel they only released overseas. It certainly doesn't justify the 300 and some million dollar budget. But they're set up for another movie, and they'll make their money back, but it's all coming from overseas dollars. Guardians of the Galaxy had another great hold, dropping less than 50%, which is incredible for the third week of a movie. Put that in perspective. In 2 weeks, it made more money than Quantumania did in its entire run. And that had a bigger opening weekend. It just shows that each of these movies play differently and do have a different trajectory. They're not all the same. The next piece of news I want to talk about, we had the big changeover from HBO Max to Max, and that did not go very well. Well, it depended on what I was doing. If I was using my Roku, all I had to do was update the app and it updated to Max, but I still had to sign in again. And on my phone, I had to download an entirely different app and then sign in from that. And it didn't go great. It went better than some other technical things that happened on Twitter this week. We won't talk about because that's not the kind of show this is. But it was not a great relaunch. And then they had this weird little thing that happened where it started to list in the credits as creators. And they no longer broke out directors and writers. They just said creators. And they kind of threw everybody in that lump together, which, of course, caught people's eyes immediately. And then HBO Max was like, oh, well, no, it was a glitch. It was a glitch. We didn't mean to do it. And then you got these programmers coming out of the woodwork going, no, there's no way to glitch this one up. You deliberately lumped everything into one bucket. And that's exactly the reason why we have a writer strike going on right now, and why you're probably going to get a director strike, and why you're probably going to get an actor strike, is the producers look at movies and the people who make them as disposable, and then it's the producer that's really the one who does all the work. It's almost like the creatives were like, oh, well, we need paprika in this, so here's our spices. You know, writers and directors are not a spice rack. And HBO Max and Warner Brothers Discovery and Max and everybody got a kind of a harsh lesson on this. And then what's real interesting is under the cover of the HBO Max debacle, Netflix decided to start letting people know, hey, we're going to cancel your account, or we're going to ding your account if you share your password. And however they do it, they look at where you are located and where you're charging it from. And they're going after people for password violations. But they were really smart, and they did that on the day that HBO Max launched, so people were talking about it less. It was a strange week for streaming. It was just a very, very weird week for streaming. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which is coming to Paramount in just a couple weeks, June 15th.
I sense a tension, a feeling that something's in the air.
Oh my God.
Our job puts us up against death. And we might not like it, but we do have to face it.
Hold on to your saddles.
Surprise!
Live long and prosper, Mr. Boimler.
One of the things I love about Strange New Worlds is they go back to what originally Star Trek was this exploration-type movie. Part of the problem with Discovery is they drop you in this Klingon war, and you're like, can we go back to what the original inception of Star Trek was? And there's some great things in this trailer. It looks good. I like the cast for the most part. I love the fact that they're going to be doing that Lower Decks crossover. The one thing I do not like about this new Star Trek, quit trying to give Spock a sex life. No amount of retconning around will show that Spock wasn't doing this stuff. In the first series, that's not what he wasn't concerned with this stuff. And then on top of that, my least favorite character in that series is Christine Chapel. Not because I don't like the actress, and not because I particularly have a problem with the character she's playing. It's just that Christine Chapel is nothing like the Christine Chapel you have in the original series. And it's not like the actress of the original Christine Chapel had a problem with a little bit more of a sultry character, because Majel Barrett went on to play Deanna Troi's mother in The Next Generation, and she was a huge sex pot in that. Just make another character. Why do you have to take a character and change it so 180 degrees out of phase with the way the character really is? She was kind of a prude, and I thought that was kind of fun, which was part of the reason why she was attracted to Spock in the first place, because, you know, Spock was so stoic and standoffish. It kind of worked, and yeah, it was the 60s and all. But then they have this character here, and she's just like, oh, I do whatever I want to, and I'm edgy and weird. I'm like, that's not the character. At least Uhura, they at least, I can see the character of Uhura in Star Trek Strange New Worlds turning into the character of Uhura in the original series. There's just no connection whatsoever. Not everything needs to be Grey's Anatomy. Just dial that crap back. The next trailer I want to talk about is The Color Purple, the musical, which is coming out in theaters on Christmas Day.
Today, our teacher taught us about a place called Africa. She say our mamas come from Queens over there. That means that we, royalty. Even if we have to part, you and me,
us have one heart.
You must ain't got no kinfolk around these parts.
All I had was my sister. She was the only one ever loved me.
I've never seen The Color Purple. I've never seen the original that Steven Spielberg did. I guess I'm going to have to watch it in the next 6 months, just at least for comparison. But, you know, hey, this one, it looks like it's going to be a good musical. I don't know anything really about the story, so I don't know how accurate it is, but at least I'm intrigued. I'm curious to see where this goes. I've got some homework to do on this one, I guess. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Starling Girl and The Wrath of Becky. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump in the movie reviews and talk about The Starling Girl. A teenage girl becomes a pariah in her community when she has an affair with a youth pastor.
Ben Taylor asked your dad about courting you.
I've never really talked to Ben.
17 is the time to start thinking about these things. Your eldest, we haven't seen him since his return.
Oh yeah, he's a youth pastor.
Lord, I know I've given in to lustful thoughts and actions that take my focus away from you and onto me. I know that's wrong.
What were you doing there?
You cannot tell anyone right now, okay?
This is one of those very low-key movies. It's a very slow burn. It takes its time. It's that independent, fly-on-the-wall kind of movie where you're watching this community, and it takes a while to sort of ease into the story and even see where the story's going. And it takes place in a very small, close-knit, very conservative community. I think it's in Kentucky. And it's a very conservative Christian community. And this girl is involved in this dance troupe. But it's that thing where it's like, oh, no, you can't bring any glory to yourself. It has to be all for God. And so you don't want to stand out as an individual. It's all the stuff about religion that, in my opinion, you take it a little bit too seriously. And it's a little bit overly constraining. And like, her father's a drug addict who's reformed, but it still has his struggles. But it's not uncommon to see somebody go from a life of debauchery, so to speak, and go very conservative. And so that's a very real thing. And it's a smaller part. He's played by Jimmy Simpson. I think he does a fine job. But it shows why this guy chose this community and why he chose this his wife, who is very, very conservative and repressed, I think is an accurate term. But the whole thing is this girl, teenage girl, ends up having a fling with this youth pastor. And it's meant to be that sort of sit back and watch what happens without pointing it out necessarily, without stating it. And that's fine, because I never like it when a movie states the obvious. If you put something out there, you should be able to get it. You don't have to explain it to the audience, and they don't. But one of the things that this is trying to highlight is what happens when there are dalliances and sexual indiscretions within a church situation. And overwhelmingly, when that stuff happens, the woman or the girl is often the one who gets the brunt of the blame, because she's the temptress. And that's hardwired into religion. I mean, going all the way back to the Garden of Eden, it wasn't Adam who sins. He was tempted by Eve to sin. That wasn't his fault. And that's one of those things, going all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, that's one of those things that can get misinterpreted over and over and over and over and over again. And it shows up all over the place because of sexual desire. I mean, that's the stuff that's going on with Samson and Delilah. That's always, women are seen as the Jezebel, as the temptress, as the agent of evil just because of their ways. And really, in modern society, we got to get past that, because that's nonsense. It's not the female's fault if a guy has an affair. It's both their faults. They are equally culpable. And that's kind of one of the things this brings to light. I mean, but there's reality. I'll tell you something that happened. I grew up in a suburb, upper middle class suburb in Ohio. And I went to this church. It was a community church. It wasn't some like out in the flyover country. It wasn't a rural area. And there was this leader who was one of the leaders of, he worked with the youth group. And this guy was creepy AF. This guy was creepy. And there was this thing where this one teenage girl, and she was teenager, like 16. And they did a thing at the church where they auctioned off people doing jobs. Like, I went, I cleaned a woman's garage. My mom put my, she'll do it. And she donated, $50 to the church. And me and a couple guys went and cleaned her garage. And one of those things. And this one girl, who my sister knew, had volunteered for something. And this guy, this creepy youth leader, basically hired her to do it. But then he drove her around. He didn't actually have her do anything. It was the creepiest story I heard. Yet this guy was like a deacon, eventually an elder in the church. And people knew this stuff was going on. He was a, I don't know if it was just him being creepy and not realizing it, because I think there is the opportunity for that to happen to some people, or if he, I don't know if he was trying to get with her. But that stuff was in just a suburb of a big city. I can't imagine how pervasive that stuff is in some of these other, you know, very, very close-knit communities where they want to protect the power structure. So Starling Girls, it's a good movie and it's worth seeing. I mean, it's a low-key slow burn, but it is filled with a distressing amount of truth. And that's why I'm going to say it's worth seeing. I'm going to say the Starling Girl kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Wrath of Becky. This is the sequel to Becky, which came out a couple years ago. It came out during the pandemic. It was one of those early pandemic movies that was from a smaller studio, Quiver. And what it is, a cast against type, they had Kevin James playing this white supremacist. But anyways, this is the sequel. Following her fight against white supremacists who killed her father, Becky escapes foster care and targets another hate group.
It's been 2 years since four neo-Nazis invaded my family's lake house and murdered my father. I'm 16 now. I've run away from three foster homes.
Saving our country and stopping the treason one vengeful mission at a time. To freedom.
Who is it?
It's Becky.
You took my dog.
No! It stars Lulu Wilson, who she plays this girl, and she's, you know, after she killed all these white supremacists who murdered her father, she was put into foster care, and she escapes and wants to go on her own, and she stumbles into another group of white supremacists, basically. Basically, these insurrectionists who want to kill the senator or something like that. And Sean William Scott plays the leader of this group. And again, sort of casting against type. He's not the goofy, silly guy that he normally plays. He's very straightforward and very dark. And I think that's neat that they do that. But it eventually just sort of sets this stuff in motion, and it turns into a Home Alone bit, you know, where she violently dispatches these guys. And I mean, it's, you know, at times uncomfortable and at times just gloriously violent and bloody. But this sets the stage for a cathartic franchise. I mean, this is the second movie in it. And I would love to see like a Becky and John Wick crossover. That would be fantastic. But, you know, interesting thing in terms of the writer's strike here, you've got Lulu Wilson, who's the actress. And I don't know if she's 18 yet, but she's a girl, teenager at least. And she's an executive producer on this movie. That's how you get paid in Hollywood. Being the star or being the writer or being the director, that doesn't get you paid. Getting as the producer, and that's one of the things they're fighting against in the writer's strike. And I thought that was interesting that I'm like, well, here's a girl who's, what, a third my age or less, and she's an executive producer of a movie because you can't make these movies without her. But yeah, this is a great, shockingly violent movie, and it's not for everybody. I mean, I'm not going to show my mom. She would not appreciate it. But if you like the violent revenge films, Wrath of Becky rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Little Mermaid and You Hurt My Feelings.
Under the sea, darling, it's better. Don't wear his sweater. Take it from me.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Little Mermaid. This is the latest live-action/CGI hybrid update that Disney has done to its animated films. In this live-action Disney remake, a young mermaid trades her voice for legs when she falls in love with a prince.
You broke the rules. You went to the above world.
A man was drowning. I had to save him.
This obsession with humans has to stop.
I just want to know more about them.
Ariel! Don't!
Poor child.
I can help you. You can't live in that world unless you become a human yourself.
Is that even possible?
It's what I live for.
I absolutely adore the original Little Mermaid. I talked about that last week. It was the film that brought my love back to Disney films. Like, as a little kid, everybody, all kids love Disney. But then you become a teenager and you get jaded. But Little Mermaid's what brought me back. It's such a beautifully simple film. And I was very nervous about what they would do with this. Because in general, and I think most people will agree, these live action / CGI hybrids of Disney animated films, the mileage varies on these. Some of them did extremely well, like Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. Some of them not so much. I was not a fan of either Aladdin or Beauty and the Beast. They just made me want to rewatch the original. I liked The Lion King, though. I thought that was a neat adaptation to it. But then some of them have been really bland or not very good. Like Dumbo was kind of a mess. They didn't know how to handle that one. I know a lot of people maligned the Disney Plus Pinocchio remake they did last year. I thought that was fine. I thought it was, you know, kind of a one-to-one comparison of the movie. Generally, the closer they get to preserving the original structure of the film, the greater is my affection for it. And when it comes to The Little Mermaid, one of the things I was really worried about is all the our marketing stuff I'd seen, it was very dark. And I think part of that's because it's like in night scenes and in Ursula's lair or something like that. But I was pleased to see that with some lighting problems, for the most part, it's a vibrant, colorful movie. And I think it looks great. I think they do a great job realizing the Under the Sea and evolving it out of cell animation into CGI. I think it looks gorgeous. Also, cannot be stressed enough, Halle Bailey as Ariel, she is fantastic. I mean, she is what makes a movie. When she's on screen, especially when she's singing, I'm there. I was totally involved because she's this mix of innocence and wonder and Disney magic. And I mean, she embodies what Ariel is. And over, for the most part, the songs are fine. Not all of them. All the ones from the original version, I was fine. You know, they retained those. Those are generally pretty good. They did not have Les Poissons, which upset me, but I understand why, because they're dealing with trying to get photorealistic fish and creatures, and so that could have been a butcher shop horror show. Although I would have loved to have seen it on the cutting room floor. But they do add some songs. They do this one called Scuttlebutt, which is just awful, and it's because it's jarring. It's by Lin-Manuel Miranda, and it's this big old sort of rap thing that he does, which doesn't fit with anything else in the movie at all in any way.
Hey, have you not heard that scuttlebutt?
Your butt.
No, the gossip, the buzz, the who said what, who does that, yeah, the scuttlebutt.
And the other thing they do, and the movie's way too long. It's like 2.5 hours long, 2 hours, 20 minutes. And they do what they did with Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. They expand the story, which unnecessarily needs to be expanded. I mean, these are short, efficient stories. And so they pad it out. Like Prince Eric gets his own song, which it's beautifully shot, but I couldn't hum any bars from it at all. I have no idea what it sounded like. And it was completely uninspiring. But because it's not his movie, it's Ariel's movie. Why are we spending 5 minutes listening to him sing on a ship? It reminds me of that scene in Aladdin where they gave Jasmine her own song. And I'm like, it's not Jasmine's movie. Why is she getting a song? Now, like some of the other characters, I thought Javier Bardem was kind of boring in it. He sort of does his very stoic, quiet role, and that just doesn't click. It comes across as almost creepy. I didn't mind Scuttle, and I, you know, as long as she wasn't singing Scuttlebutt, and I didn't mind, I think Flounder was fine, and Sebastian was fine, but, you know, Melissa McCarthy as Ursula, I felt like she was struggling to find where she belonged in the movie. It felt like she didn't know exactly how to perform, because when you heard that she was playing Ursula, you're like, oh yeah, she'd be great, but then you're like, oh, her big comedy is very different than the big comedy of Ursula. Ursula is almost, honestly, you know, they should have gotten Harvey Fierstein to play Ursula and drag queen makeup, because that's kind of how the original Ursula is. She's this haughty, throaty voice, and she's very big on the Broadway stage, but, you know, Melissa McCarthy, it's not her shtick, and so I think she struggles to kind of find where she is, and she's fine with what she does. But ultimately, it all hinges on Halle Bailey. And I mean, the music's still there. It's still a beautiful film. I think the family are going to like it. It's not perfect. I mean, it is. It's imperfect. And it's too long. But the film is saved by Halle Bailey because she shines through. I mean, she is the reason to see the movie is she is beautiful. She's sweet and her voice is fantastic. And that's what makes the movie work. So I will still say that The Little Mermaid rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about You Hurt My Feelings. A woman in New York City has a personal crisis when she discovers her therapist husband doesn't like her work as much as he claims.
So, Elliot tells me you're a writer.
In your last one, it should have done better.
There's lots of new voices. Refugees, cancer, murder, abuse.
I'm an old voice.
You're the best voice.
Maybe if Dad hadn't just been verbally abusive, it would have been a bestseller.
He's been lying to me this whole time.
I wasn't lying. I was encouraging.
That's not true. You were lying to be encouraging.
You know what? As an actor, Mark isn't always great.
So the times when you don't think he's good, what do you say to him?
You are so fantastic.
Really?
There is a genre of film that are like these New York City therapy movies. These New York City angst-filled psychological problem movies. They were pioneered by Woody Allen. You know, back in the 70s, you know, stuff like Annie Hall, Manhattan, all these kind of things about a guy who's just worried about everything and he constantly needs to go to his therapist and he sort of, you know, putters around New York City and that mantle was eventually passed to like Noah Baumbach. And this falls into that, at least what I feel, that kind of genre of a film. Now, it's not directed by Woody Allen or Noah Baumbach. It's directed by Nicole Holofcener. And she gives a different brand of it. Her version is different. I mean, she still gives that New York City, I need to go to my therapist type of movie. Now, Julia Louis-Dreyfus stars in it, and she's good in it. She works really well. And I mean, she still hasn't stepped too far outside of her Seinfeld persona. And it really is just, it's about a bunch of people discovering that white lies exist, I guess you could say. I mean, it's one of these things where people think they have a good life and that everybody likes them and the people that they love are, their words of support are in fact truthful all the time. And they're not, we know that. Generally, if somebody writes a story and they hand it to me and say, do you want an actual critical analysis of this? Or do you want somebody to tell you you're brilliant? Because if you want somebody to tell you you're brilliant, go take this to your mother and let her read it. But the reality is we lie to each other all the time. And that's what this movie is. It's almost like people are discovering this for the first time. And it really causes them to spiral. And if you like watching the people get all worked up over that, that's what this movie is. But the reality is this stuff happens all the time. Well, a great example, this show. This is my show. I've done hundreds of episodes. My family doesn't listen to this show, and I'm not hurt by that. They don't care, which is okay. It's not their cup of tea. You know, and I'll write things, and I'll have my wife read them. I don't, you know, I mean, I'm usually writing horror stories and science fiction stuff, which is not what she's into. You know, it's not a romance. So I'm not really worried about her personal opinion. So, I mean, but You Hurt My Feelings is fun. I mean, it's a clever little movie, an angst-filled New York City therapy movie that has some fun and real moments. I'm going to have to say You Hurt My Feelings kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about FUBAR and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Influencer.
First I cut off their heads and I pull out their bones. I'm a weasel, ça c'est toujours délicieux.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews. We're going to do a TV show this time, and that is FUBAR. This is on Netflix, and it stars Arnold Schwarzenegger. The reason it got a lot of note is because it's the first time he's ever done TV. He showed up on TV before. I mean, you've seen him on TV, but this is the first full-blown series he's done. Now, it's not on broadcast TV. It's on Netflix. And there are 8 episodes in this series. A retiring CIA operative must come to terms with the fact that his daughter is also an agent and then must work a mission with her.
You are officially retired.
How are you going to spend your golden years, huh?
My daughter's in the CIA.
What the f***? In this place, it's f***ity f***.
dollar in the swear jar.
I know where the WMD stored, so follow me or get out of my way.
She clearly has daddy issues.
He treats me like a child.
Alcohol, cigarettes.
Take your daughter to work day is going well.
Now, the True Lies TV series flopped and it is gone. It doesn't exist anymore. But this feels very True Lies-ish because the whole thing is you've got spies who don't know the person in their life is a spy. The difference is Schwarzenegger and his daughter, played by Monica Barbaro, are both agents. They just are unaware of each other's involvement in the agency. Whereas in True Lies, at least in the Schwarzenegger film True Lies, he was a spy, but his wife, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, she was just a housewife. She got pulled into it. But this one, of course, Monica Barbaro is she can hold her own, and she's the Maverick agent. If you don't know who she is, she was in Top Gun Maverick. She was the only other woman who wasn't Jennifer Connelly in that movie. She was the pilot, the female pilot in it. And she's okay in this. But part of the thing with her, and I felt this with Top Gun as well, it's almost like she's trying too hard to be tough. If you bolster around too much, it makes you look silly. She comes across as trying too hard, at least to be the hardcore agent that will do anything to get the job done. Schwarzenegger's been doing this for decades, so this comes easy to him. And it does kind of go to his roots. It goes to his action roots. It's run by Nick Santora. Well, he's best known for doing Prison Break and like Breakout Kings. But recently he did The Most Dangerous Game on Quibi and Roku channel. And I talked about the second season of The Most Dangerous Game, which wasn't as good. It's something that's meant to be really macho and chest puffy, but at the same time, it throws in that level of humor. I appreciate the humor, but sometimes the humor is very misplaced in this series, where they do something that's funny, but it just feels awkward at the moment. And it has an okay cast. Like, they have Travis Van Winkle and Fortune Feimster are his handlers. And, I mean, Fortune Feimster's funny, but she's like a one-note shtick. Everything I've seen her in is kind of the same thing. The character's the same. You get that a lot with like comedians, especially somebody who comes up through the stand-up thing. They're basically playing their persona. Aubrey Plaza did that for years. I mean, that's basically her onstage persona that went all the way through Parks and Rec. Overall, it's a fun series. I haven't seen all of it. One of the things they do that I actually really do appreciate about it is they end every episode in a cliffhanger. I mean, not just a what happens next, but it's sort of like it's like watching 24, if you remember that series with Kiefer Sutherland, where, you know, something's happened and you think everybody's going to die at the end of every episode. And it's a great way to push that binge watching thing. And you can watch the whole thing on a Saturday. I mean, you know, it's only 8 episodes. You can burn through it. It's nice to see Schwarzenegger doing something at least a little different in doing, well, he's playing the dad, and he's played a dad before, all going all the way back to like Commando, but playing the older dad and allowing the age jokes in there, although he needs to get somebody else. Just go gray. You're the top of your head looks silly when it looks in the same color as Chuck Norris's beard. It's an enjoyable series, but it's not something, as much as it pushes the binge watching by having those cliffhangers, it's not a show that I think I could watch in huge chunks. So it's a nice return to action for Schwarzenegger, but it feels a little bit too cheeky at times as a TV series. But still, like I said, enjoyable. It's a fun little action series. I'm going to say FUBAR kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I want to spotlight a film that is premiering on Shudder, which you've heard me talk about Shudder many times before. It's a horror and thriller streaming service. If you get AMC Plus, you get like that included. Although you can get Shudder as a standalone service as well. But this is directed by one of the people who was involved in VHS 94, which was, it's not the most recent VHS movie. you know, the anthology, but he had worked on the previous one from that a couple years ago. But this one's quite different because, you know, it's a very slick looking movie. An influencer, a social media influencer, meets a mysterious woman on vacation who assumes her identity.
You're in one of the most beautiful places in the world. What could possibly be wrong with that?
My boyfriend and I planned this trip together. And at the last minute, he bailed.
You can come crash with me. I'll show you.
Right. Looks like I'll be staying here for a while longer. We're going to explore the country.
You probably brought me all this way to kill me. In the middle of the ocean. No one can hear you scream.
No, I'm not going to kill you.
Well, that is disappointing.
Back, gosh, like 20 years ago, there were a series of movies that were sort of like these cautionary tale travelogues. Stuff like Hostel or Turistas, where people would go to a different country and then something horrible would happen to them and they get caught and mutilated or killed or whatever. And this feels like it's cut from that cloth. And it's sort of, it is that throwback to those movies, you know, probably more Turistas because Turistas takes place in this beautiful sort of tropical wonderland and they're in Thailand. The locations look fantastic and the cinematography looks fantastic. But it's sort of told in like three, most movies are told in three acts, but the three acts are very distinct. And I kind of like that because it's almost like they're 3 half-hour chunks that could be, you know, three episodes of a TV series. And it is that cautionary tale, but one of the things it does is the people in this movie are not smart. Normally, I get really annoyed when you got characters and they're dumb. You're just like, oh my God, really? How do you not realize this? But there's a realness to that. George Carlin had a great line. I'm going to paraphrase, but it's basically like, you don't think people are stupid? Think of how dumb the average person is. And half of them are dumber than that guy. So some of these people are, you know, they may be talented in getting likes, but these people can be really stupid. But it's realistic, stupid things they do. And the main character, the CW, the girl who is the fatal attraction woman in this, she takes advantage of everybody and she knows how to push buttons and she's the smartest person in the room. And everybody, when you think, oh, they've got her, you're like, oh, well, wait, maybe they don't have her because they're just stupid. But people are dumb sometimes. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that you're literally watching people at times going to their death because they're so stupid. So there's a strange humor to that in this movie, but it's also a very clean, well put together movie. It especially coming from the VHS movies, which are rustic and grainy and they look very different. It shows that the director, Curtis David Harder, he knows his thrillers. He knows what would normally happen in a movie like this. And it's not that he changes things drastically, but he diverts enough off course that you're not quite sure where it's going. I mean, there are certain things I figured out pretty early, but it takes you down a slightly different path. And sort of like the movie Missing, if you remember that movie Missing that came out earlier this year, it deals with technology and what's possible with technology, and it's disconcerting. It makes you worried because you're like, oh, can somebody really do this? And to the answer to this, if you know how to manipulate things, yes, you can. So yeah, I mean, this is a neat little thriller, nice little horror movie. If you got the Shudder streaming service, check it out. I'm going to say, you know, it's eerie and disturbing. This cautionary tale of self-awareness has some solid thrills. I'm going to say that Influencer rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and the Boogeyman Across No Boogeyverse. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.